We're going to begin discussing the halachas of the Seder. Seder means order. So, as I implied in the title, there's a schedule for the night that Chazal made. Far from being constricting, it's not meant to restrict that. So, there's only one way to do the Seder, although that's true to some extent, but the structure is itself liberating. And I don't remember where I saw this the other day, but the fact that let's say B'nai Yisrael were rushing out and, they're like, putting everything on the back and the matzah, and we're rushing the matzah and all of that. So the fact that that was Pesach leaving Egypt versus Pesach at home, when you have the luxury of sitting around the table and going at a leisurely pace. So the whole structure of the Seder sort of enables that, and also gives us the ability to observe Pesach in a meaningful way, as opposed to kind of leaving it up for us to sort of figure out what it means to be free and all that. So the Seder gives us that structure. Sometimes structure is quite liberating. I would say that as we go through these items, I think most of it's going to be familiar. Maybe some of the details could be new information, but the general structure, we know what we're supposed to do at various points in the Seder. I think what will be interesting to look at tonight is the origins of different parts of the Seder and the development of them in the halachic process. So just to start off, when we look at the Torah does not tell us Vasita Lil HaSeder, on Pesach night. The Torah doesn't mention anything about a Seder. The mitzvahs of the night, as mentioned in the Torah, are V'yigadol Talavincha B'yom Ahu, that we're supposed to tell the story. That's one mitzvah. And then there's then the Korban Pesach along with the Matzah and Maror is another mitzvah, or maybe there's a couple of mitzvahs there. But those are the main features of Pesach night in the Torah, is telling the story and eating Korban Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. In addition to that, we also now have the four cups, which is rabbinic, as we'll see. We have Hallel. Hallel maybe is an outgrowth of telling the story. But those are the most pertinent features. So we're on page 301. On page 301. So as an introduction to the four cups, can you see here? Is that helpful?
I want you to have your maybe
I can see.
grandma something over there.
Kol kos v'kos, this is the Rambam in Hilchos Chametz Matzah. Kol kos v'kos be'arba kosor ha'elu mevar chala bracha bifnei atzma. So we make a bracha before each of the four cups. They are separate. Kos rishon omer alav kiddush hayom. With the first cup, we say kiddush. Kos sheni kore alav es haggadah. Second is for the haggadah. Kos shlishi mevar chala birkas hamazon. The third cup is for benching, for Birkas Hamazon. Kos Revi Gomer Alav Sahalo. Mevarech Alav Birkas Hashir. In the fourth cup, we say Halal and what's called Birkas Hashir, which is a whole discussion in the Gemara. Uvena Kosos Ha'elu Imra Talishtos. If I want to drink between the first and the second cup, I may. If I want to drink between the second and third cup,
And
which
third
is
cup, which is
essentially the meal itself, so that's okay. Be'er Shlishi Revi Eino Shobta. But between the third and the fourth cup, we don't drink, and certainly after fourth cup, we're not allowed to really taste anything besides water. One thing that's perhaps noteworthy, you can unmute yourself if you have questions, but just for the sound feedback. Some of the cups, again, constitute really their own mitzvahs anyway, right? So Kiddush is a mitzvah regardless of a mitzvah of the four cups. Benching ala kos, so there's a question of the chicken or the egg here. Do we have a mitzvah? Do we know that there's a mitzvah to bench anytime with a cup of wine based on the fact that we do on the Seder night? Or is it that since we have to have four cups, so and we usually bench with a cup, so that becomes the third cup? So each cup, could be explained in different ways, but we have these four cups. We'll explain the source of that in a second. Look on page 302, starting with Kaddish, and really framing again the whole concept of the four cups. So the Gemara in Pesachim says, "Tanu Rabbanan Hakol Chayavim ba'arba kosos halalu." Everybody is obligated to drink the four cups. Echad anashim ve'echad nashim ve'echad tinokos. Men, women, and children. I think with children, we're extra lenient with grape juice. grape juice in general is a whole discussion, but everybody's obligated in the four cups, and particularly it's brought up here, particularly with women. One thing that we go out of our way to explain when it comes to the obligation of women to have the four cups is the concept of Af Hein Hayu Ba'oto Anes, just like we say with Hanukkah candles and with Megillas Esther. So women were affected by the miracle. Obviously, what you know, the miracle was a miracle for women as well. And we could argue on some level that women are also instrumental in the miracle of Yetzias Mitzrayim, whether it's Miriam's role or maybe there's some other suggestions there. But everybody is affected by the miracle, so everybody drinks the four cups of wine. The Rambam in source three, this is a famous Rambam because of the interesting language here. He says, "Bechol dor v'dor chayav Adam laharot et atzmo ki ilu hu be'atzmo yatza ata mishibud Mitzrayim." So that's a little bit of a play on the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, as we say in the Haggadah, "Bechol dor v'dor chayav Adam lirot et atzmo." We have to see ourselves as if we left Egypt. Rambam takes it a step further and says, not only do we have to sort of imagine ourselves as if we left Egypt, but we actually have to demonstrate. We have to depict ourselves as if we left Egypt, as if that I left right now. That it's as if I just did it tonight. And he says that's based on Torah commandment. We have to remember that you were a slave, meaning you, including anybody who's reading the Torah, you were one to slave. So that's in Halacha Vav, and then Halacha Zayin. He says lefichach, which is and the word lefichach in the Rambam. When he says therefore, he's doing something very intentional in drawing a link between what was said before and what's being said now. So the fichach, therefore, when a person sits down to eat on this night, he has to eat and drink in a way that demonstrates that he is a free person. And therefore, we have the mitzvah of the four cups, because drinking wine is something that free people do. If you're a slave, you don't really get the luxury of drinking wine. Probably aren't allowed to drink wine because you can't be intoxicated on the job. So the ability to drink wine is something that's part of being free, as is hasiba, as is reclining, which we'll talk about a little bit more. The Rambam quotes the Gemara saying that really this is the first Mishnah in the chapter of Pesachim that talks about the Seder, that even a poor person who normally is sustained through tzedakah, so they have to have four cups, which is sort of an interesting statement. Why would we distinguish between a poor person and a rich person? Maybe one would make the argument that a poor person doesn't normally see themselves as being free, or maybe a poor person who's receiving tzedakah, so why, maybe give them, one cup of wine? Why give them four cups of wine? But the point is that every Jew equally was liberated on the night of Yetziat Mitzrayim, so every Jew is equally obligated in these mitzvahs. But this is all.
France, drink a lot of wine with everything. The four cups enough for
Herb asks if for the French, if they drink wine all the time, it's four cups and okay, fair question. So drinking wine, as Rambam explains, is an expression of our freedom. Rashi points to a particular source in the Torah. This is source four on page 303, that the four cups, why four cups? Keneged, thank you, arba lashone geula. There are four expressions of geula in Parshat Va'era. Vehoteiti etchem, I took you out. Vehitzalti etchem, I saved you. Vegaalti etchem, I redeemed you. Vlakachti etchem, it's actually in the future because it's Va'era, and I will take you to be my people. So according to Rashi, the source of having four cups is based on these four different action verbs of HaKadosh Baruch Hu taking us out in these stages. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach explains that the reason why it's specifically four cups of wine is because, this is on the bottom of the page, because wine gets better the more aged it becomes. So too, each stage of redemption is a better one. My favorite explanation of it is that the Netziv is that every cup of wine is literally going to change your appearance. It's going to change the way you look, like your spirit changes and your countenance changes. So we look a little bit more redeemed each time that we have a cup of wine. That's the Netziv's explanation for four cups of wine. And basing that on these four stages of redemption. Okay, so how much do we have to drink for each cup? So that's a discussion in the Gemara and the postgame. So in source five, the Gemara simply says, Amar Yitzchak Bar Nach, Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, v'hu de'ashtei ruba de'kasa. Person has to drink the majority of the cup. So it sounds like no matter how big my cup, so, you know, it was just perm a week ago. So when I was in yeshiva, when I was in the Gush, so I went to my Rebbe's house for Suda, and he said that as far as wine goes, you're allowed to have one cup. I don't care what size your cup is, but it has to be a cup, and you can have one cup. So if you want to bring a cup that's that this big, you know, Zagizunt, if you bring a cup this big, that's all you get. So if at my Seder I use a cup that this big, do I have to drink the majority of the cup? What's going on there? And is a shot glass enough? That's another question, right? So Tosfos source 6 says Ruba Dakasa means Melo Lugmav. Melo Lugmav is a cheekful, which above they define as being about 50 to 55 cubic centimeters, which is volume. So Tosfos says that the idea is that we're supposed to drink the majority of a revis. We're supposed to drink the majority of a revis. Melo Lugmav, a cheekful, is a majority of what we call a revis. So therefore, the idea when the Gemara says that you have to drink most of the cup, it means that we're assuming that the volume of the cup is a revis, and therefore you have to drink only a cheekful. That's how Tosos understands it. Whereas in source 7, Beis Yosef brings the Orchos Chaim and the Ramban that Tzarech Lishtos Rov Mikol Kos Afil Machzik Kamar Viyot, even if you have 10 revi worth volume in your cup, you have to drink the majority of that cup. So that's a fundamental dispute between Tosfos and the Ramban. Do I only have to drink, when we say majority of a cup, does that mean the assumption is the cup is only the size of a revi'it? And even if it's bigger than a revi'it, I still only have to drink a cheekful? Or do I have to drink the majority of a cup no matter what it is? And it could be that there is a difference. So normally when it comes to the laws of Kiddush, the Baruch explains the source is that there's a difference, maybe there's a difference between Kiddush and the four cups. With Kiddush, as long as I even taste the wine, that is that's enough. And by the way, when with Kiddush, even as long as one person, preferably the person makes Kiddush, but as long as one person tastes the wine, that's enough for everybody else. That's with Kiddush. What? Right. Friday night is technically speaking, as long as the person who makes Kiddush drinks, so that's really enough. That's really enough for every. That's really enough for. So of course, it's nicer when every. It's better for. I think this comes up. This is actually the Gemara in Pesachim. I think the Rashbam says that it's better that everybody drink. But technically speaking, not necessary. So that's for Kiddush on Shabbos. But when it comes to Pesach, so we have a mitzvah of arba kosos. You have to drink four cups. So maybe that's a little bit different. Maybe that's why. You have to drink more than just tasting it, and maybe that's why, according to the Ramban, it's different than Kiddush. Maybe you have to drink the majority of the cup because it's four cups. It should really be the whole cup, or at least the majority of the cup. Rubo kakulo, you know, the majority is most of the cup. So that's right. That's right. And that's one thing that also makes Kiddush different than. That makes four cups different than Kiddush is that everybody has to drink as opposed to just the Mekadosh drinking it. So Shulchan Aruch Paskins in source 9 that the cup itself, sorry, the amount that should the minimum amount of wine is revis lecharshim zagenu. So they used to have to dilute the wine. It was came as a sort of like a stronger syrup, and then you mixed it with water. So after mixing the water with the wine, you have to have a total of a revis, which we'll define in a second. And then he says you should drink all or the majority of the cup. And he says if there are many volumes of revis, so everybody has to drink however many revis are in the cup. So the first thing he says is that if the cup has more revios, and then actually you could pour out from the cup if there's enough for revios for everybody else. So let's say there's 10 revios in the cups, you have 10 people at the table, so you can pour it for, you could just pour it for everybody else if you wanted to. He says that, and he says there's some people who say that you should drink the majority of the cup even if it has many forms of Reviews. Maybe, maybe. So, Mishnah.
Usually make everybody drink some Kiddush, or even if one person makes the Kiddush, everybody drinks one cup anyway. Is that usually what happens?
That so usually when you make Kiddush on Shabbos, so everybody drinks, but you're not technically obligated to on Shabbos. As far as Kiddush is concerned, there's no requirement for everybody to drink. Only the person making Kiddush, or even one other person, has to drink. But when it comes to four cups, everybody has to drink. That's part of because everybody's obligated in Arba Kosos.
But
So
usually you don't see anybody pouring out for Kiddush, right? Like, I mean, it's usually the person's had their own cup. They get
At the Seder?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. At the Seder, everyone usually has their own cup. But he was saying that if you have a really big cup, in theory, you could pour it out for everybody. The Mishnah Berurah explains that so generally speaking, if I have a cheekful that's usually enough with the four cups, it's a little bit we're a little stricter. And maybe you didn't fulfill your obligation at all if you didn't drink the majority of the cup. But he says, technically speaking, having a cheekful is technically enough after the fact. And with that said, if one does not plan to drink a lot, so one should take a smaller cup, right? You should try to take the smallest cup possible. That's halachically valid if you don't think you can drink all that much, which is my general advice, and that's what I do. I take the smallest cup possible. Four cups of wine is a lot. Now, between one and two and two and three, there's a long time, but it's still a lot. So better that we're able to do the mitzvah properly within that framework than kind of have to, rely on leniencies of drinking a little bit less because the cup was bigger. The Mishnah Berurah explains in source 11 that the drinking should also take place within a certain period of time. So we have a concept of achilas pras, which is eating literally part of half a loaf of bread. So that's defined for drinking as being about 4 minutes. That volume, I guess, is considered to be about 4 minutes. So ideally, the whole thing should be consumed at one time in like one sitting, or maybe a couple of sips. So, but at the very least, one should drink the entire cup within a few minutes. But if you sip on the cup and, for 10 minutes you're sipping on the cup, then you haven't fulfilled your obligation for that particular kosa and you would have to drink again, says the Mishnah Berurah. So with that said, how big does my cup have to be, right? So we keep saying that, Ravis, if it's bigger than Ravis, so a kosher bracha always has to have, be able to contain a Ravis. They're just like everything in Judaism, there are different explanations for how big a Ravis is, and part of that has to do with, how the measurements change. And so Rav Chaim Na holds that a raviz is 86 cubic centimeters. Rabbi Yehuda and the Chazon Ish hold that it's 150. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, I believe, was a little bit in between that. Moshe Feinstein was a little bit in between that. So there are some who say that that you should maybe it depends on whether it's a deraisa or derabanan. If four cups are derabanan, so we can rely on a smaller amount. And truthfully, I recommend again relying on smaller amounts. On the one hand, you could say that if you're going all out and you're going to be a God-fearing person, you try to fulfill all opinions, so then you should go for the 150, which is that's about I think 5 ounces, 5.5 ounces. A God-fearing person should fulfill all opinions and drink the biggest, biggest cup possible. With that said, with what with 4 cups of wine, it is. I mean, in my opinion, I don't know. Well, okay, but grape juice, but grape,
86
sorry,
isn't enough.
what?
So 80-60 cc's is enough for the cup for the
Yeah,
coast to be.
yeah. So I don't remember exactly what it is. I think it's about three. How many fluid ounces
86 cc's
is
is 3 ounces.
86? Oh, it says 3 ounces.
Yeah.
Is it 2.9? Well, round of the three.
Point now. Okay. Because I have a
Three
small
ounces.
coast.
Three ounces. So I go with 3 ounces. And so her brought up, well, maybe if you go with a bigger cup, so then you'll switch to grape juice. But then that also kind of requires a leading to you of drinking grape juice as a 4 cups, which is justifiable on some level, but So usually it's right. So Rav Soloveitchik held that the first cup should be wine because wine is wine is the best way to fulfill the mitzvah, and with Kiddush maybe there's a special mitzvah to have wine specifically. So those are considerations when it comes to the four cups of wine. Again, try to drink the majority of the cup of wine, but use the smallest cup possible. That is, 3 ounces or a little bit over 3 ounces. Actually, I measure, if I forget from year to year which cup holds how much, I measure to try to make sure that I'm taking the smallest cup I have. Okay, the mitzvah of reclining. Is another way the Rambam mentioned that reclining is also an expression of freedom. That was something that was actually true in the period in the the Second Temple period in the Greco-Roman context. So that was a demonstration of being royal, or at least being of being a certain class, was that you reclined while you were eating. That was normative. So that's just an outgrowth of. How do we show ourselves as being free? So we do it the way that the people around us do it. So that's what the Rambam says. It's a manner of freedom. It says, okay, so in the, and again, in source 44, he, we quote the, quote the same thing that we mentioned before. So in source 15, the Ravia brings up an interesting question. So once upon a time, reclining was a normal thing to do, and it was, and that was an expression of freedom. But at some point in history, people don't eat while reclining anymore. And not only is not an expression of class and freedom, etc., but it's not normal. It's probably uncomfortable. So does this mitzvah still apply nowadays? So the Ravia, who's one of the Baalei HaTosfos, so you're talking, close to 800, 900 years ago. He says, a person should sit normally because leaning to your left essentially is not reclining. That's Ravia's argument. Reclining is you're on a couch and you're lying down on a couch. Mm-hmm. Now that people don't do that anymore, so you should sit normally because that's how normal people eat. What? Yeah, the pillow. Gevaldik, the pillow. So, fine. So how do we paskin here? Well, I'll tell you how we paskin and tell you how I do, and you don't have to paskin like me, but I'll tell you what I do. We'll get there in a second. So Shulchan Aruch says that when k'shu meisev lo yatzal gabo lo panav lo yimino el aspolo, that when you recline, it should be to the left, not on your back, not on your face, not to the right. So Gemara brings different considerations that if you're lying, if you're lying backwards, so you'll choke. If you lie to the right, if you lean to the right, there was a concern that that could go down the wrong windpipe. Mm-hmm. So that's why the Rama says there's no distinction between left and right. So there's two reasons to recline to your left, either because for righties it's easier to eat like that, or because they were concerned that it would go down the wrong windpipe. So. We paskin like the opinion that it's about the windpipe and not what makes it easier. So therefore, left-handed people should recline to their left. So anybody's required to recline if they do the four cups with the matzah without reclining. So they have to go back and redo that mitzvah. So then the Rama says as follows. This is, again, in 16, where it says Haga or Rama. Some say that since reclining is not normal nowadays, so what happens if I didn't recline? So maybe then I can rely on the Ravia that since reclining is not normal, that it doesn't really matter. And he says that because that with the third and the fourth cup, you certainly shouldn't go back because we're not supposed to add cups. We're not having a sixth and seventh cup. That's not part of the Seder. So if you repeat a cup because you didn't recline, so maybe it looks like you're adding on to the cups. So he says definitely in that case you shouldn't go back and drink. So normally Pesach in the Shulchan Aruch is that we do recline, we lean to the left, unless if you forgot, so maybe you don't have to go back. The other issue that comes up says the Shulchan Aruch, and this is based on the Gemara. Shulchan Aruch says, source 17, Isha ena tzricha haseba ela imken hi chashuva. A woman does not need to recline unless she is an important and prominent woman. Okay, so if she has a certain, she's a wife of a macher, or she's a part of, or she's maybe the wife of a talmid chacham or something like that, so then she reclines. If not, then she doesn't recline. So this Rama is amazing. This Rama is amazing. The chol nashim shalanu mikre chashuvos. Whoever said that in the medieval times that they were backwards, so Rama says that in 15 whatever that in the 16th century that our women are considered important, and then so in theory all women have the right and the ability to recline, except women don't recline, and why not? Because of the ra'avia. Since reclining is not really a thing nowadays, so the men are machmir and do it, but women don't really have to because they're not obligated to. And even though our women are important and prominent and run the household, and really the husbands do whatever their wives tell them to do, et cetera, the fact is that reclining is not normative nowadays, so women don't have to. Oh, it's interesting, right? Our women, meaning the Jewish women, as opposed to, he could mean that, but again, I think he's comparing with the time of the Gemara. So I do not lean at my Seder because Rabbi Jeremy Weider, my Rabbi Mufak, I think compellingly argues that leaning to left isn't doing anything. I mean, because it's not reclining. That's not reclining. Reclining again is being on a couch. So he essentially says that the Rav is correct. So most poskim for the last 800 years have not accepted the Ravia. Rabbi Weider's point is that it just doesn't, you know, that leaning just doesn't do anything. So it's not you're being machmir, but what are you accomplishing? So I'm not going to tell people who have the custom of leaning that you shouldn't lean, but I've adopted my Rebbe's Zapsaka. I even discussed it with him a little bit this morning. I was discussing some of this other stuff. Yeah, we had a whole conversation around this.
The Abbott situation. So, did you lean? You didn't let lean. You remind them to lean, and then
so they're not leaning, and you remind them. Yeah. You're right. Right. So
the minute you remind them, they're still. Well, because it's like this, and then they start spilling the wine.
And so Herb's saying maybe nafkamina also. If let's say somebody's in the middle of drinking and they're not leaning, do you have to remind? Do you have to remind them? So maybe not. Okay. Let's talk about Orchatz and Karpas. We'll be brief. Orchatz, notel yadav, this is on page 310. Notel yadav letzarech tibul rishon velo yevarech al hanetila. So we wash our hands for the first dipping with a Karpas. We don't make the brach. So what's the purpose of this washing? So some say it has something to do with making the kids ask questions. Really, it's actually based... Or I would say, I mean, maybe that there's some truth to that also, but really there's a requirement to wash your hands if you're going to have a fruit or vegetable that's dipped in water. So really there's an obligation to wash for that year round. So it's not commonly followed anymore. But I would say it's still a halakha that should be followed. So when I have grapes or something that's washed, so I wash. You don't make a bracha because maybe nowadays, so there is a discussion more so than bread when it comes to other things we dip. So maybe nowadays, since we don't have issues of tumba and we're all impure for corpses anyway, so maybe the mitzvah doesn't apply anymore. So safek brachos lahakel, we don't make brachos if we're not sure whether or not we should do a mitzvah. So we don't make a bracha. But the idea of orchatz is not necessarily something that's additional to the Seder, since we're having karpas and we're going to dip our karpas into the salt water. So that requires washing hands.
I think it's also not using utensils. You're dipping it, but if you're using a fork.
You're using a fork, then there's no reason to wash your hands, right? Right. I mean, technically speaking, if you're having bread, if you're picking up with a fork, yeah, there might be a reason not to wash.
I would assume that even if you're not making a bracha, that you should not talk from the time you wash until after you make the burp, your dhamma, and any gazayas. Is that correct?
I don't think
you shouldn't talk after washing. Because
I don't think there's a concern about not talking, but there's a concern about not touching. And that's the thing that people also forget about washing for bread, is that less of a concern about than less of a concern than more sorry, it's more of a concern than talking between washing and eating is touching things that you shouldn't touch. Right? If you touch yourself all over the place after you wash, you should really wash, because that's the whole thing by washing is that we're touching things that are not pure. So it doesn't harm not to talk between washing and karpos, but I'm not sure if it's because there's no bracha, and really the issue is what you do with your hands, not talking in this case. That's my hunch. So 311 on page 311, source 21, Gemara says that hevi lefanav metal bechazeres. So we bring vegetables, we bring out vegetables, and it's dipped in chazeres, or you dip the chazeres in water or vinegar. So that it's conspicuous distinction for the children, so that they'll ask questions. We want the children to stay awake, so we do funny things to make them ask questions. That's the purpose of karpas, according to the Gemara. So there's a discussion about whether you should eat a kazayis of the karpas, whether you should eat a kazayis of the karpas. The Rambam says that you should, because there's no significance to eating less than kazayis. The Rush says that maybe you was that the Rush? So the Rush also agrees that you should have a kazayis. There are so the Shulchan Aruch comes and says that you should have less than a kazayis, because then you have a whole question. It's gonna be a long time since you have your next vegetable. So maybe you should be saying a bracha achrona if you eat a kazayis. So in order to avoid that question, we eat less than kazayis. We eat less than olive's worth. But when we make the bori pri adama, we do have in mind that it's going to cover the maror. Together, all that stuff is going to be kazayis. Fine. Okay, we're going to move on from here. Yachatz, on page 313. So again, yachatz is not a mitzvah from the Torah. It seems to have a more symbolic purpose. So the Gemara in Pesachim says, "Amar Shmuel lechem oni lechem she'onim alav dvarim." What's the purpose of when the Torah calls matzah lechem oni? It's called lechem oni because it's the same root as answering, that we answer our questions with the matzah in front of us. Davar acher lechem oni aniktiv. Since a poor person eats, only a slice of bread and not necessarily a whole piece of bread, so too, while we're telling the story of leaving Egypt and we're talking about the struggles of slavery, so we have a broken piece of bread in front of us. So the Gemara has both of those reasons. So Shulchan Aruch tells us that we take the middle matzah, we split it into two, and one is kept for it. One is kept hidden away for the apikomen, put it in a cloth, and the other is placed under the two matzahs and is used for the mitzvah of al achilas matzah. Prima Gadim says that you should break the matzah with a hand and not with a utensil, because again that's more indicative of sort of the oppression involved in lechem oni. And the Mishnah Berurah quotes an interesting custom that some people put the yachatz on their shoulders to, you know, make it resemble leaving Egypt. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's both layers of that. Okay, and then we'll just end by talking about Magi.
Rabbi, before you go on, I have a question about that you're supposed to have in mind. When you say bar pridama, that you have to have in mind about the mara, that always bothered me, because you're going to eat the mara already after hamotzi. So after hamotzi, you don't make separate brachas on everything in your meal. So why do I have to have in mind the bar pridama when technically you wouldn't have to make a bar pridama anyway?
It's a good question, except that maybe with fruits and vegetables, we actually do make a bracha. If it's not necessarily something that's part of the meal, like if I'm having, broccoli as part of my meal, so I don't make a separate bracha on it. But maror especially for us, is not really part of our meal. So maybe it does require a separate bracha. So I think that would be the concern. Okay, so Magid. Let's give a brief overview of Magid. So in source 30, the Mishnah, it's really a Mishnah in Brachos, tells us that we're supposed to mention Yetzias Mitzrayim every night. We learn that from the words Kol Yemei Chayecha, that the word Yemei Chayecha means I mention Yetzias Mitzrayim every day. Kol Yemei Chayecha means I mention Yetzias Mitzrayim every night. So every night when we say, every day when we say Shema, we say Vayomer, Ani Hashem Lokecha Masher Otzeiti Etchem Eretz Mitzrayim, we're mentioning leaving Egypt. We fulfill the Mishnah. We fulfill the requirement brought in this Mishnah. So some of the Acharonim are bothered by the question then, what's different about the Seder? If we mention Yetzias Mitzrayim every day, so what makes the Seder so much different? I mean, we know it's different, but fundamentally, conceptually, why is there, what's different about really the Seder, what we're doing at the Seder, than mentioning Yetzias Mitzrayim every day?
4 days a year.
So you're saying it is the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay, so that's... well... Manishtana halayla hazeh. Okay, so Minchas Chinuch gives a suggestion that the main difference between the Seder night and the rest of the year is that the rest of the year, when I say Shema, I'm saying it to myself. The Seder night, v'igat halavincha, there's a mitzvah to tell it to my son or to somebody else. That's why the children have to be up, because the children have to be there for v'igat halavincha. So that Minchas Chinuch says that that's the main difference. In Source 32, a very famous piece explanation by Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Grach, gives three different distinctions between regular nights of the year and the Pesach Seder. Number one, during the rest of the year, I just have to mention Yetzias Mitzrayim, but at the Seder night, it's Behagada, that I have to tell the story, that I ask questions. So he sort of incorporates that piece of Minchas Chinuch, that there's a conversation going on, but it's also sort of the question answer thing is unique to the Seder night. That's one thing. The second thing that's unique is that we tell the whole story. So the third, so you know, when I say Shema, I only should mention that we left Egypt, but the night of the Seder, we go through the whole development of we were slaves and now we're free and everything in between. And then the third distinction is that we have to explain the mitzvah, we have to explain the Pesach Matzah Maror, and what those represent. So that's also a component of telling the story of leaving Egypt that's not done the rest of the year. So I could take a whole, you could make a whole shir out of Rav Chaim Brisker, but it's, you know, worth thinking about, you know, that these are things that make the Seder night unique and cater our experience towards them. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach explains that not everybody has to say the Haggadah, but if one person is saying it, so everybody who's listening is Yotzei through that. In terms of, you know, in terms of engagement, it's, I think it's nice when everybody participates in reading in some way or another, but it could be sufficient for one person really to say the whole thing. So one thing that the Ramah mentions on page 317 is that when we say the Haggadah, V'yomer b'lashon sh'mevinim ha'nashmak tanim, so again, under the assumption that women were and children were less educated than the men at the table, so it should be said in the vernacular. So obviously nowadays it's not, you know, just one particular gender, but you could have men also who don't understand what's going on. So you should either say the Haggadah in language that's understood, or you should explain, you should summarize. So he says that the Ri of Landari would say the whole Haggadah in the vernacular so that everybody could understand it. And that's important, because if the purpose is to tell the story and we're supposed to connect to the story, the mitzvah is not to read the words. The mitzvah is to talk about it and to understand it and internalize it. So it makes sense that everybody should be understanding it. The last thing I'll mention, I might talk about this one of the nights between Mincha Maariv, but everybody sort of assumes that, you know, with the implied in the question of how long was your Seder, that the longer your Seder is, the firmer you are, or the more hardcore you are if you spend more time on a Magid. So according to Shulchan Aruch, that actually might not be true. The Rambam does say within Magid, Kol Marbe Harezim Meshubach, the more that one tells, that's Meshubach. But the other side of that is that maybe the mitzvah really is And also maybe a machlokas between the Mishnah and Tosefta, but maybe the mitzvah of elaborating on the story is after the whole Seder, that we're supposed to stay up until, you know, the sleep fills our eyelids. So that's when we, you know, go on and on and on about the, and that's maybe actually indicative of the five sages in Bnei Brak. Why were they, they weren't eating the afikomen until after sunrise? No, it's because that they had already done the mandatory parts of the Seder, and they're discussing everything after. So I think it's something to think about also. I've heard that Rav Herschel Schachter Seder, they literally just read the Haggadah, and they go on. So, you know, a balance of reading the Haggadah and discussion is certainly good, but there could be some very practical reasons why, with Magid, that the mitzvah is to tell the story, and a little bit of engagement and asking questions is certainly enhances that mitzvah. But I think if you finish your Seder at 11 o'clock at night, it doesn't mean you haven't fulfilled your obligation. That's what I'm saying, is that that's sort of the implication of that question. Now that it's almost 11 o'clock at night, I'm going to let everybody go. Have a good night, and we'll continue our session next Tuesday.